This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After FDR was elected president in 1932, Eleanor Roosevelt worried that her talents would not be used, that she would become a White House shut-in, a congenial hostess in the political shadows. That's how Blanche Wieson Cook begins the second volume in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, which covers the years 1933 to 38. The newly published book goes on to document how Eleanor Roosevelt countered her fear by becoming an activist first lady. The book also describes the Roosevelts' unconventional marriage. During the White House years, Eleanor and Franklin had separate quarters and separate courts. FDR's closest companion was his secretary, Missy LaHand. Eleanor's closest companion was Lorena Hickok, perhaps the most prominent woman reporter of the time. My guest, Blanche Wieson Cook, is a distinguished professor of history at the City University of New York. Cook says Eleanor Roosevelt transformed the role of First Lady.
Well, she really is an activist in the White House. You know, she's the only First Lady in U.S. history who actually reaches for her pen when she disagrees with her husband. She disagrees with him about his very first act, which is the Economy Act, which results in the firing of federally employed women. And Eleanor Roosevelt is outraged. She writes, "This is a stupid, foolish, unnecessary act." She disagrees with him about international relations and writes an entire book called This Troubled World in 1938. Why doesn't he support the World Court? Why doesn't he understand the need for a League of Nations? Why doesn't he promote collective security? You know, these are all burning issues with her. And she writes about these things. She speaks about them. She was very angry that Social Security in 1935 came in segregated. And she went on a national speaking tour saying, this is a law that's going to have to be amended every single year. It's really quite an extraordinary feat that Eleanor Roosevelt performed.
By the time Eleanor and Franklin Roosevelt entered the White House, did they have an intimate marital relationship, or were they just kind of strong companions?
Well, I think I don't answer those questions because I say very clearly we don't know what people actually do in the privacy of their privacy. But it's very clear that Missy LaHand lives in the White House. Missy LaHand is treated by Eleanor Roosevelt as the junior wife.
And Missy LaHand was FDR's personal secretary and also his close companion.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, she had a very hard time with Lucy Mercer, who was the first woman who really almost crashed their marriage. And Eleanor Roosevelt really never adjusted to Lucy Mercer, but she adjusted completely to Missy LaHand, who after 1920 was FDR's most, you know, important and intimate associate and friend and assistant, and picked up all of the social obligations that Eleanor Roosevelt, in her many travels, didn't do.
In Volume 2 of your biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, you describe her relationship with Lorena Hickok as the most ardent and absorbing relationship of Eleanor Roosevelt's middle years. You first wrote about their relationship in Volume 1 of your book, and, you know, implied that their relationship might have been an intimate one. What kind of reaction did you get from readers who thought that even the thought of Eleanor Roosevelt as possibly having had a lesbian relationship was shocking?
Well, I was actually surprised by the outrage some people felt at the possibility that Eleanor Roosevelt had love in her life. There were people who came up to me at parties, including a human rights worker who said, "Oh, are you that disgusting woman?" And I said, "Well, I might be, but, you know, what do you mean?" And she said, "Well, did you write that book about Eleanor Roosevelt having lesbian friends or a lesbian affair or some such thing?" And I asked her if she'd read the book, and she said, "No, I wouldn't read it. I wouldn't touch it." And this woman was a human rights worker and a writer. And it really gave me great pause. There's an incredible amount of bigotry and refusal to contemplate that Eleanor Roosevelt had love in her life, whether it was with Lorena Hickok or with Earl Miller. And I think there really are people who just don't want to hear this. On the other hand, I feel that what I do here without characterizing the relationship is simply tell the story. And I feel very free to tell the story because Eleanor Roosevelt left us the documents. She wrote to her daughter, "I'm giving all my letters to the library. You remove anything you don't want history to know." And since Eleanor Roosevelt intended us to have this record, I think she intended us to know, you know, some of the struggles that she endured as a woman who intended to live a very full life. And I'd also like to say, you know, this is not merely a romantic and delightful story, because it's a very changing story. At some point, Lorena Hickok gives up her career. And when Hick gives up her career, the nature and the intensity of the relationship changes.
Well, first of all, why did she give up her career? We should say that Lorena Hickok was the most highly paid woman journalist of her time. She wrote for the Associated Press and, in fact, met Eleanor Roosevelt because she was covering Eleanor Roosevelt shortly before Eleanor Roosevelt came to the White House.
Well, that's the story. I mean, not only was she covering Eleanor Roosevelt, she was actually covering FDR. She was the highest paid woman reporter, but she was the woman reporter assigned to presidential politics. She didn't do first ladies. I mean, this was a very powerful, influential Associated Press reporter. And she gave up her job because she got too close, as Louis Howe, their mutual friend, said to her, "You should never get too close to your news sources." And she couldn't tell all that she knew as the children's divorces were coming in. She couldn't tell the secrets of her best friend. And so she resigned. And Eleanor Roosevelt encouraged her to resign and never fully appreciated what it would mean to Hick, who had worked so hard to become, you know, the number one woman in the game, to give up her life's work. And so, the moral is never give up your career for the woman or man you love.
How did it change the relationship?
She became unhappy. She became depressed. She became dependent. And Eleanor Roosevelt had part of the excitement about Hick was that she was so independent, was that she was such a self-starter. She was really Eleanor Roosevelt's guide. And when she became depressed and unhappy and grumpy, it really hurt. But not only that, she expected for her great, effort in this relationship, she expected to have a unique relationship with Eleanor Roosevelt. And Eleanor Roosevelt was really involved with the political world around her, and she couldn't give Hick the kind of time and the kind of attention that she needed. And it's a big part of the story.
Couldn't Lorena Hickok have just changed beats so that she wouldn't have been expected to report on the Roosevelts?
Well, Terry, you know, I said it's a big part of the story. There's a great big push-pull in this relationship. She says to Eleanor Roosevelt at one point, "I'm going to go off and be a foreign correspondent." And Eleanor Roosevelt says, "No, don't go. I want you here. I want you near me." And every time she starts to push away or pull away, Eleanor Roosevelt pushes or pulls her back. And that's a very big part of the dynamic between them.
I believe a lot of what you learned about the relationship between Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok come from their correspondence, which was made open to scholars after Lorena Hickok's papers were opened in 1978. Can you read excerpts of one or two of the letters that you think are most enlightening about the nature of their relationship?
Well, there are two, actually. One is on page 42, and Eleanor Roosevelt writes, "One day marked off, my dear, may I forget there are other reporters present, or must I behave? I shall want to hug you to death. I can hardly wait. The nicest time of the day is when I write to you. You have a stormier time than I do, but I miss you as much, I think. I couldn't bear to think of you crying yourself to sleep. Oh, how I wanted to put my arms about you in reality instead of in spirit. Please keep most of your heart in Washington as long as I'm here, for most of mine is with you." And that, of course, is early in 1933, when the love and longing and pining is really still at its height. Then there's another one on page 187, and this is you know, really kind of evidence of how far apart they've gotten in a very short time as politics and history and time really intrudes on their happiness. Hick, dearest, I know how you felt today. You couldn't let go for fear of losing control, and being with me was hard. Darling, I love you dearly, and I am sorry for letting my foolish temperament make you unhappy, and sorry that your temperament does bad things to you, too. But we'll have years of happy times, so bad times will be forgotten. And there are two themes here that are repeated over and over. One is every time they're apart, their longing is extreme and intense. And then when they get together, their expectations tend to crash. And then Eleanor Roosevelt writes immediately thereafter, you know, when I'm free of these obligations, you know, we will go off together, we will live together, we will retire someplace. And she makes really very amazing and vast promises. And then even they begin to taper off. So it is a very turbulent and stormy relationship.
How long did their relationship last?
Well, actually, their friendship lasted throughout Eleanor Roosevelt's life. I mean, she dies 10 years before Hick does, and they are friends to the end of their life. I actually think the passionate and stormy part really begins to end by 1935, when Eleanor Roosevelt makes the great decision that politics is her primary love, and she just doesn't have time or space or temperament for the kind of demands that Hick makes. There's one moment where Eleanor Roosevelt arrives in New York after she's called Hick and said, you know, meet me at the train and we'll have a private weekend. And she gets off the train with Tommy, her secretary, Malvina Thompson, who is, you know, her very dear and devoted friend. And she's gone up on the train with her to take dictation and help write articles and do all the things Tommy made possible. And Hick sees them get off the train together, and she just storms away. And it's that kind of tension that at some point Eleanor Roosevelt decides she just can't handle and do all the work she wants to do.
You said you don't really want to characterize the relationship between Roosevelt and Hickok. You just want to describe what it is that they've said to or about each other, because that's all the evidence you have to go on. So does that mean that you don't feel certain how physically intimate they were with each other, or whether it was just the intimacy of friendship that they're describing?
Well, what I said is I leave it up to the reader, and I prefer not to characterize it, but it's very clear to me that this is an ardent, passionate, intimate relationship.
What did Franklin Roosevelt think of the relationship between his wife and Lorena Hickok?
Well, I actually think Franklin was relieved that his wife had friendships outside of their own partnership, because he had friendships that were very important to him outside their partnership. And I think he encouraged his wife to have friends. He encouraged the building of Val Kill with Nancy Cook and Marion Dickerman. I think he was relieved and grateful for Eleanor Roosevelt's friends. And I talk about how chummy he is with Hick and with all of the people in Eleanor Roosevelt's life.
My guest is Blanche Wiesen Cook. Volume 2 of her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt has just been published. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Blanche Wiesen Cook, and we're discussing the second volume in her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, which has just been published. You write, Eleanor Roosevelt and FDR didn't have a traditional, correct, or conventionally happy marriage, but it was one of Washington's most notably successful marriages. Fueled by power, they were each dedicated to making life better for most people. Together, they did more than either could have done alone. Is that really the basis of their marriage, their political interests, and their political alliance?
Well, I think it is the basis of their political alliance and their enduring friendship. I want to say one other thing, which is that I believe Eleanor Roosevelt loved Franklin to the day he died. He couldn't have hurt her so much if she didn't love him so much. And so there is always a part of her heart that is in pain, even though, because she's a competitive woman, she intends to, you know, make the best of this and have her very own life.
Did she have an understanding with her husband about what political domain would be hers, where it was, like, quote, okay for her to become an activist, and where the president really wanted her to stay quiet or out of the picture?
Yes, I think they really did have an agreement. She never did anything that would really hurt him. And when he tells her, very often there are memos to her, which I quote in the book, saying, you know, write nothing, do nothing, say nothing about this. And there's one issue which Eleanor Roosevelt maintains complete silence. And I have a chapter in the book called A Silence Beyond Repair. And that has to do with the silence both FDR and ER maintained for, you know, so long, from 1933 to 1938, about what was happening in Hitler's Germany and what was happening to Jews all over Europe. And this is a terrible story, because what we have from Eleanor Roosevelt's record is everything that came into her. The realities of what was going on in Dachau were printed in the Reader's Digest and sent to Eleanor Roosevelt in a very pained letter in 1934. So it's a very bitter story. And at one point, I didn't even want to finish the book. It was such a bitter story until I heard, I read quite by accident in Varian Fry's memoir, Nothing I Could Have Done to Save the 2,000 Jews. And this is the man, you know, the Holocaust Museum had an exhibit on Varian Fry. He saved the best and the brightest, people like Pablo Casals, Marc Chagall, Hannah Arendt, on and on. And he said, nothing I did could have been done had it not been for Eleanor Roosevelt. And I realized I was looking in the wrong place. I mean, Eleanor Roosevelt actually had, you know, a kind of covert operation when it came to international affairs. This was true for the Spanish Civil War, and it was true for refugees. She really did everything she could to save individual lives. And then one of the compelling aspects of the story is how she dealt with what was going on in Europe by committing herself to fight injustice in the United States, anti-Semitism in the United States, race hatred in the United States. So A Silence Beyond Repair is a very important and very disturbing, haunting part of the story.
My guest is Blanche Wiesencook, and she's just published the second of her multi-volumed biography of Eleanor Roosevelt. And the second volume begins in 1933 and ends in 1938. I think a lot of Americans prefer it if their first ladies are glamorous. And, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt was a physically plain-looking woman, and her buck teeth had the potential of making her kind of awkward-looking. I'm wondering if she was ever uncomfortable or insecure about her looks, if she thought much about, you know, whether she was attractive and whether that mattered.
I think she did. I think that was the one area that she was vulnerable. She hated how she looked. Although I have to say, and I met Eleanor Roosevelt many times, she was very striking. She had, you know, she was 6 feet tall. She wore clothes beautifully. She cared a lot about costumes. And she had the most incredible blue eyes. And once she had a car accident and her teeth were, she had new teeth, she was very attractive. And if you look at the pictures in the book, she really isn't as homely as she thinks she is, but she's very self-conscious about how she looks. And her cousin, Alice Roosevelt Longworth, constantly mocks how she looks in print and on the radio. And Eleanor Roosevelt, she could make Eleanor Roosevelt cry. So that too is a theme in the book. But that was the only area that she was vulnerable to criticism.
If you had the chance to actually ask Eleanor Roosevelt a question, what would you most want to clear up that still confuses you about her life?
Well, you know, Eleanor Roosevelt left the most amazing record. She is so clear and direct about what she thinks and what she wants. that there's not a whole lot of confusion. I mean, I don't feel there's a whole lot of confusion about her public life. What is confusing is what was the nature of, for example, her relationship with Earl Miller. This is a very important friendship to Eleanor Roosevelt.
He had been her bodyguard.
He had been her bodyguard, and he remains her page and her squire and best friend. You know, it's Earl Miller who gives her the rambunctious dogs that nip at other people and bite, particularly women of the press. And he's trained these dogs. I don't know if he's trained them specifically to bite women of the press, but that's who they bite. And he's there. He's, you know, he's just part of her court. And every single one of his letters has disappeared. So that's certainly a relationship we don't know enough about. The letters to Lorena Hickok burned the first year of their correspondence, which one can only presume was the most ardent year of their relationship. And then she typed out the political part. And so there are things that we just don't know that were lost to history. So it's really in the relationships that I would want yet more detail.
Blanche Wiesencook, Volume 2 of her biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, has just been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.